Hi, welcome to the River Talk podcast. This is a podcast about, I don't know, rivers, rafting, whitewater, kayaking, whatever we feel like talking about. Hosted by Priscilla Macy, Eric Weiseth, and me, Zach Collier. And Eric's off doing Eric stuff, which I'm not sure what that is today. But my friend Dougie Fresh is going to guest host. Welcome, Dougie.
Thank you.
And we're going to do an interview and talk with my friend Dustin Abbott about heuristic traps in a minute. I'll introduce him. But first, I'm going to go into news of the week. And I don't think Priscilla has anything, but my two quick things. One, we are hosting a Wild Rivers Night February 6th in Portland, if you can make it. And I'll put a link to the tickets on our website. It's just a fun night of like getting together, talking about rivers, drinking some beer. There's not really an agenda. Like we don't have anything to promote. We're just getting together because Patagonia is nice enough to give us a spot. So if you're in Portland, that's an event we're doing. And the other thing is I recently have been working on this this river guide quiz, and I put a draft online, and it's an okay quiz. I made, you know, there's some questions I made with like questionable answers. And I'm working on a second draft right now. But if you want to take the quiz and give me feedback, I'll put a link on a website too. So
what's the purpose behind the quiz?
Well, we took an IRF course last spring, an International Rafting Federation guide course, and I thought the quiz was terrible. Not terrible. I just was like, this could be a lot better, and so I decided to try to do it on my own. And it turns out it's hard. So I'm trying to make a better quiz for like guide schools or that kind of thing. But it's hard.
Yeah, quiz writing's really hard. Way to go for taking it on.
Yeah, it's been kind of fun though. So far, I've had 130 responses to the quiz, and I think our next podcast, I'm hoping I can get Jeff Compton on. And we can go through the answers one at a time and have discussions about them. I think that'd be a fun podcast. And then I want to based on feedback, I want to rework it and make it even better. So it's been a fun project, actually. And I've learned a lot doing it. So that's been good. So I want to introduce our guest, Dustin Abbott. Dustin's a longtime friend of mine. He's a river guide. I've guided with him a bunch. And he's a NOLS instructor. He's an American Canoe Association swiftwater instructor. He's a International Rafting Federation trainer. Trainer. And he just finished his Master's of Outdoor Adventure and Expedition Leadership from Southern Oregon University. Did I say that right, Dustin?
Correct. Yes.
Cool. So he has a lot of experience. And our friend Nate Wilson sent us an email asking us to talk about heuristic traps, and Dustin is the only person I know who knows what that even is, and so we wanted to introduce Dustin to the podcast and maybe talk about heuristic traps. So welcome, Dustin.
Awesome. Thank you, Zach.
Yeah. And so first of all, just could you tell us what a heuristic trap is?
Certainly. Well, heuristics are something that we use daily. A heuristic is really it's kind of a shortcut to decision making. Simple things like stopping at a stop sign would be considered like a heuristic. So these are things that are used all the time. But in the backcountry or in a river environment, we have like a dynamic environment, and we often find ourselves like utilizing these shortcuts, but sometimes they can we can fall into traps utilizing some. They came up. This was the heuristic traps. This concept was really developed out of research to better understand why professionals in avalanche terrain were consistently being involved in avalanches. And they came up with this acronym, this mnemonic, which in and of itself is a heuristic of facets, right? So I think it's important to understand that like while we're talking about like these traps and heuristic traps, that there's this kind of dialectical concept to them that they are good and we use them all the time, whether it's learning your wilderness first responder and the patient assessment system. But to better understand these kind of six that avalanche safety experts have come up with. And they use this acronym FACETS, which ironically is kind of a snow crystal. and they're, you know, familiarity, acceptance, consistency or commitment, the expert halo, tracks, and then the scarcity trap. And I've seen a number of different variations of this, but that kind of like lays out the six.
So let's just go back a second. When you use, I still don't understand heuristics. Like, explain the stop sign thing to me real quick. Like, why is that a heuristic?
Because it's something that's telling you what to do. We utilize, in like when you approach a intersection, you don't have to make a decision. There's a sign there telling you that you need to stop. And so we trust that sign to be making the decision for us, that, that's a good decision.
Okay. And so before we get in, facets, I guess, are the different types of heuristic traps. Before we get into that, though, just like, can you give us an example of what a heuristic trap is? Like one example of what it's like, what it could be in real life, maybe.
Sure. I guess the first thing that comes to mind, since we're talking about, since it's a river podcast, you've traveled a long way to get to a river that you're going to boat, and maybe you've underestimated the flow. And when you get there, the water is brown. Maybe it's in flood stage, and there's trees, you know, debris and stuff floating down the river. This type of like commitment trap would be to say, well, we've come all this way, and so we're just going to go, instead of analyzing the situation and thinking critically about the decision that you're making. You've fallen into this commitment trap. Well, we've traveled a few hours. We're here now. We're going to go.
Okay. And so it sounds like there's six different types of like buckets of traps. Do you mind walking us through each one?
Sure. So starting from the top, this familiarity trap, you know, we all have our local rivers that we boat down. I'm sure you guys are well familiar with sections of the white salmon. So you go and you boat this section maybe daily or weekly, and you have a very good understanding of what it is. But rivers are dynamic, and so you may get complacent because of the familiarity with that river. Does that make sense?
Yeah, you know, I just saw a post on Facebook today of a guy who was doing laps on a river in Mexico, and on one of, they were training for a race, and on one of the laps there was a tree in the middle of a rapid that was like pretty gnarly. Would that be a familiarity trap, an example of one?
Sure. I mean, like I said, the you know, river environment is dynamic and it's ever changing. So yeah, just being aware that those things change and that, you know, what hazards, you know, hazards change. So just, I like to think of it as going into every, like every time you go down the river, thinking of it as like, you know, a new experience versus something you've done over and over and over again.
Let's go back 1 second too. So when they're called traps, it basically means these are bad things, right? Like a heuristic trap is like a thing you, heuristic is something, a signal of something makes, have you to make a decision. Trap means that thing gets you in trouble.
Correct.
So the getting caught in any heuristic trap is like typically a bad thing.
Correct.
Okay, just so I understand the definition. Sorry, I'm kind of slow with this stuff.
No, that's great.
So, cool, what's
another
next one?
Example. Oh, I was going to say, just for you, Zach, since you're thinking about rescue stuff and like guide training, one of the heuristic traps that I often talked about in whitewater rescue classes is always following the rules that you were taught in, you know, a controlled environment, like, you know, always set up a Z-drag anytime a raft is pinned. You see that a lot on the river. Yeah. When if they just thought critically about the scenario, maybe just a push off the rock would have worked. So that's another example of how just practicing the same thing over and over again without critically thinking about it can sometimes put you in that trap.
Right. And that might be like this consistency trap, right? Like this is the decision that we've always made. So we're going to continue to make it. Or this is what we've been taught. So I'm going to continue to make this decision.
Cool. Do you want to keep going down the types?
Sure. So that, I mean, that was a good example of this consistency. We talked a little bit about commitment trap. I really appreciate this one, the expert halo. And that's kind of, you know, when you're going out with a group of people, oftentimes you just turn to the person with the most experience. And so you just rely on them to be making all the decisions for you. And that may not be the best, you know, the best practice. They could be making mistakes. I like to refer to this heuristic, this mnemonic that I consider fault. Anytime somebody's in like pain, hunger, they're angry, lonely, tired, this affects their decision making. So being able to communicate effectively with the person who's leading, and being able to openly express any concerns or doubts about the decisions that are being made, might help you avoid that expert halo trap.
Sometimes do people just accept that the expert is the expert and don't question them because they have so much faith in them? Is that part of the problem?
Exactly.
Or is it that sometimes people who aren't the expert are afraid to question them, or is it both?
I think it's both. And that gets into another trap of this social proof or acceptance, where you're looking to be accepted by your group of peers. And you don't want to ruin the day by saying, hey, I don't think this is a good idea. We should probably turn around and go home. So there's this kind of nervousness. There's this inability for people to voice their concerns.
And the social proof is not always just acceptance. It's also like trying to seek acceptance. It's also, well, they made it down, so I'll probably make it down too. That type of thing. Or they're starting to, they're putting in on this river, so we can do that too, type of thing. Yeah.
And that's super common in like avalanche terrains where, you know, like somebody may see that's like another person has skied this line. There's tracks there. So somebody else skied it and they made it down fine. So it'll be okay if I do the same thing.
So far we talked about familiarity, acceptance, consistency, expert halo, and sounds like social proof. Are there any more?
This one that Dougie talked about, like tracks or scarcity. You know, like you're traveling to Kyrgyzstan, Zach, and you get there and you've traveled all this way, and this is, you know, to boat this river is a once in a lifetime opportunity. That I won't get to do ever again. So that's also a trap. Or the flow only comes up during the spring, and this is the only day that we have to do this river. Avoiding that. You know, again, critically analyzing the environment that you're in and making a good decision at that time and not falling into that, like, well, this is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
I have another good example of that one too. I was taught this for sea kayaking in Baja. But like, let's say it's Friday and you're out sea kayaking and you have a flight on Saturday or Sunday, so you have to get back home. You have to make that flight, but it's kind of windy. You might push the envelope a little bit because you know you have to make that flight. So it's kind of pushing you to go harder than you would have thought before. But since you want to make that flight home, you'll push yourself.
The scarcity one is big for me. Like, I struggle with that one because I now have limited time to boat, and I want to boat some really eccentric things. And so I would definitely do it at a higher flow. I typically go too low. That's my problem. But the scarcity one's big to me now that I have such limited time to go, and I have high ambitions for certain places I want to go. I'm sure, Priscilla, this is big for you guys, too. You do such eccentric stuff.
Yeah. Well, and we've talked about critically thinking about the choices we're making, why they're making them, and what the consequences of them might be. And I think of the scarcity in twofold. It can be a motivating factor that's healthy, where you're like, all right, I'm going to wake up at, 4:30 so I can pack and get on the road and get this rare opportunity. Or it can be something that can push you into an escalation of commitment to what you're doing because it's so rare, or you've committed resources and time to figuring the trip out, that can translate to there's a difficult rapid on the run. You know that you're only going to run this river once and you want to run it, even though ordinarily you might not want to. So that can pose a risk, which is the other side of the fold. But I think if you have taught yourself to think critically about making good choices, not necessarily being cowardly, but thinking about, well, what's the benefit of this? What are the actual risks to the group and to myself? And then making the best call, if even that is accepting some amount of risk for a good reason, I think that's okay. We certainly have talked about that a lot, like what you're talking about with limited time and limited opportunity. We might do things that other people might not be more inclined to do that are able to paddle, 4 or 5 days a week.
And I think that these decisions don't just come at the time of put in, right? Like, you need to constantly be assessing the changing environment. You may put on river and it's sunny and warm out, and an hour later a storm blows in and it starts heavily raining. And how does that impact the river that you're on and the rapids that you're running? Are you having that communication with your team? Like, what are we noticing and what's changing about the environment that we're in? And so it's not just a single decision that put in, like, are we going to go or are we not going to go? But what are the egress points if this does go bad? And that constant reassessment and constant analyzation of your environment and everything that's happening around you.
So
absolutely.
The part I'm struggling with is, I feel a little bit like this is like book work, and it's good to know this stuff, and it's interesting, but how to practically apply it. I guess the way I could practically apply it is when I go to put in, just be like, man, I'm falling into a heuristic trap. Maybe I shouldn't go. Like, help me with self-awareness. Or is it so that I can go to a trip leader and say, hey, dude, you're falling into a heuristic trap. Let's rethink this. Like, what is that the practical application, or do you see it differently, or maybe expand upon that?
I see it as as both, right? I think that self-awareness piece is definitely a sign of a good leader, and then being able to assess the rest of the group as well. And because we all know as guides that the person shivering in the front of your boat is not going to ask you for a jacket. But that at some point you need to step up and say, here, put this jacket on. And I think that this practical application that I see is, making these plans, going to put in, and with your team, developing some sort of social contract with common goals and objectives. And then anytime you have a question or need to make a decision, referring back to that social contract and those goals and objectives. If the goal is to return, have a good day and return home safely, then maybe you're portaging the class 5 instead of running. But if your goal is to summit, and that's a really important goal for you, and you're willing to lose fingers and get frostbite over it, making sure that everybody is on that same page. So when the weather does turn bad, you have something to go back to and say, well, our group goals and objectives and our social contract stated this. This might help us in inform our decision making in the future.
I think that works. Oh, go ahead, Priscilla.
I was going to say, maybe this will help you, Zach, too, is this conversation about heuristic traps and the academic side of decision making and how it applies in the field always reminds me especially when we're teaching other people to do activities or to think critically, is being a teacher, you need to be able to teach people to be good decision makers. Like, you can teach them all of the concepts in the book and have them memorize them, you know, teach them to do a Z-drag and they can do it every single time. But it's much more difficult to teach students or people coming into the sport, or even yourself as someone that's experienced, to be a critical thinker and a decision maker, which I think is kind of the essence of this conversation. And those that have those skill sets will be much less likely to fall into these traps. Of course, they're not immune to them, but much less likely to fall into them.
And I think for me, in what I do, this is awesome, right? Like, I love, like, having this, something I've thought about, talked about, and it can help me make decisions about our trips and what we do. And I think within our company, we have that social contract you're talking about. I'm trying to put myself in my head of me going private boating, though. Like, if I'm going kayaking with friends after work, and it's like three people that I know and four people I just met, like, how do I apply it in that situation? And when you talk about a social contract, are you saying, like, hey, you know, get everybody together and be like, all right, guys, you know, what are our goals for today? I feel like I'd be the nerd. You know, like, I just picture myself at Takeout for the Lower Hood being like, all right, guys, so here's our social contract for today. Today we're going to have fun. We're going to do this. Does everybody agree to that social contract? And then Dougie is like, I don't agree. I'm like, all right, Dougie, I'm not going with you. Or, I mean, how do I handle it in the situation? How is this applied to, like, a typical group of just people paddling for fun?
Right. That's a good question. I'm not sure. Like, it's, I mean, again, like Maisie said, it's, you know, this academic kind of side, and we're trying to better understand our own decision making and how to keep ourselves safe. And in the private world, you know, when we're not trying to teach this stuff in the field and teach people how to be good decision makers, you know, nobody else has this understanding. So how do we bring this about to, like, a larger community? How do you inform people, or how do you create these concepts and inform these concepts to other folks?
I think the answer is yes. You do have this discussion with people, and maybe it's the same time you talk about, if it's somebody you haven't boated with ever, you talk about paddle signals and, like, general strategies for getting down the river. And then you say also, like, what are our goals? What do we want to do today? What's our plan? What's our logistics? Just a quick discussion about that can get people on the same page. It's not common.
Yeah.
And it's harder in the private environment as opposed to commercial, because commercial, everybody knows their role a little bit better. But in the private world, it's much more complicated and difficult. But yeah, I think ideally you do have those conversations.
Destin, I know you're organizing a Grand Canyon trip. You're going on here pretty soon.
Yes.
Do you have a social contract with the people on your trip?
I don't right now, actually. I have, you know, I've been putting a lot of work into this. My days seem to get filled with, you know, just thinking about the canyon and getting everybody on the same page and dialing in logistics. But I think it's definitely a conversation that I've considered having, you know, the night before we launch, and talk about, you know, who's going to be our, you know, our med lead and our incident command, and who's going to be backing those people up. But I have not talked about, like, a social contract or necessarily goals or objectives. I guess for me, like, the goal is to have a good time and get to the end of the, you know, get to takeout safely. And that's kind of my goal every time I go on water. And what happens in between, trying to make good decisions in the moment. I've been putting a lot of planning into this trip, and, you know, I have, like, a day by day itinerary developed, but I understand that, like, that's not set in stone. If for whatever reason, wind or weather keeps us from getting to the next camp, then the following day we need to make up those miles. But that, again, we're not falling, like, I'm not trying to fall into that commitment trap of, like, I've built this schedule and this is what we're going to do. So, you know, trying to have those conversations on a daily basis, and figuring out what everybody's interests are the morning of each day.
So I
think that's a really I think that what Dustin was just talking about is a great way to approach it. He's talking about, you know, being willing to adapt to changes, not necessarily having a formal talk at the beginning of the trip, but I think the essence of it is setting expectations about the trip and understanding the expectations of others. And I think that that is really important when you're paddling with people you don't know very well, or you're paddling on a run that's new to you, or, you know, in the case of a more adventurous or exploratory run, like something that we always set an expectation about is like, if we're doing it in the winter where daylight's limited, it's like, all right, just to make sure everyone's on the same page, sundown's at 4:30, we're putting on at 10. So that means, you know, we're going to do lunch on the go and we're going to be moving quickly, those sorts of things. And then, you know, like checking in with each other, who has a breakdown, everyone have a throw bag. I don't think it has to be a formal speech at the beginning of every trip, because I think in a sense that would be falling into a trap, just doing the same thing over and over and not thinking about it holistically. But just having the mindset to be checking in with other folks and understanding the expectations of others and letting them know what your expectations are so that there's no conflict or issue as you progress downstream.
I heard a talk by Ian McCammon once about this type of stuff, and based on some of his research, he said he found that people that were very competent, when they had incidents, it was often one of these facets that they could identify, and it was often the same specific trap. So, for example, somebody that got in a few avalanche accidents, it was always trap number one, familiarity, for example. So his research was saying, figure out, like, look back on some of the incidents that you've been in or close calls that you've seen, and think about which trap you might have fallen into, and then really be careful about that specific one going forward.
So, like, you're saying we individually fall into specific, we don't all fall into all the traps. We generally, like, have our own traps we fall into.
There might be a trend, yeah, with your traps, Zach.
Yeah.
Like, you might have consistently fallen into one trap, so in the future you could really
pay attention to
that
one.
Specific one especially, yeah.
The scarcity one's big for me. I'm always like, ah, man, like, let's just do it, you know? And so I'm like, I'm hyper aware of that one for sure. I want to give an example here real quick. I'm leading a trip down the Hood River for the Oregon Whitewater Association in March. And it's people, some people I know, some people I don't know. So the social contract has me thinking a little bit. Would it make sense for me to email them all ahead of time and just say, hey, everyone, here are my expectations. Our goal is to go out and be safe, have fun, maybe do some learning. And if you, you know, but also say, like, you know, I'm the organizer, but I'd love that feedback for you if you ever feel unsafe. Like, feel free to come to me during the trip so that we can talk about the river. Does that seem like a normal thing to do along the social contract lines?
Yeah, I think that's great.
Go ahead.
I think it puts everybody on the same page, because we all come into the day with our own expectations, right? And if they're not being expressed, they're not going to be met. And then you start, like, getting into contention, because what somebody else thought they were going to do today is completely different than what you thought you were going to do today. And then you get into this, you know, angry phase, this new subjective hazard that's just been introduced.
Yeah, that's a great point. I think you pointed out something that resonates with some errors that I've made on trips before, which is kind of conversely of what you were talking about, Zach, is as the trip leader, you're setting the expectations, letting them know what's going on, opening the door for feedback. I think an important other side of that is if you are a participant in a trip or you've agreed to go on a trip with a group, that if you have any questions or you have a set of expectations that you think might not necessarily be true or whatnot, it's really important that you check in with the rest of the group so that, you know, when you get to the put in and the trip leader's like, all right, we're going to start the 4-mile hike in, you're not surprised and, you know, frustrated and angry that you didn't have the right information, because I think, you know, obviously it's different when you're teaching a class or you're leading a commercial trip. I think more responsibility is on the shoulder of the paid person or the trip leader. But when it's just more of a social group of paddlers or any other activity, it's also important for the people joining in on the trip to ask questions about the trip so that they're prepared as well.
I have an example, the same Oregon Whitewater. I don't get paid for these. This is just me volunteering for the association. So I feel like I have some responsibility, but not ultimate. But I led this trip last year, and the water was higher than when everybody drove from Portland to Hood River, I met them. I know the river really well. I've done it hundreds of times. So I'm probably falling into expert halo trap, maybe.
Familiarity.
Familiarity, because I know the river really well. It's maybe a scarcity trap because we picked a certain day for this trip and people drove out from Portland. And we met them in the morning, and I think it was 6.5 feet, which I feel incredibly comfortable on. And I knew half the boaters, and I knew they'd be fine. And so some of them would express some, like, hey, we're a little worried about the flows. And I'm like, I feel good about it. Let's go do it. And we did it, and we had a great day. It was safe. I felt it was safe the whole time. And but that same day, another similar group being led by somebody like me had a fatality. And it made me rethink. And I think people on our trip that day think about that a little bit, in terms of like the, you know, how safe was it to be out there? And so I'm putting that into context in terms of these heuristic traps that I could have fallen into.
Yeah, I think that's a great example. I mean, you see that in like that tracks heuristic, right? Maybe they saw you guys putting in and were like, well, it's good to go. I see, you know, Zach down there, and he, you know, he's done this a bunch, and he thinks it's safe. So, following that expert halo and that tracks heuristic. Yeah. And I think that we see that a lot as well. And I think that that's what's, you know, spawned this research, is that sort of decision making in avalanche terrain.
Cool. Do you guys have any, I think examples here are really cool. Do you guys have any examples of times you've seen this happen in real life?
Well, I have some personal examples of, I think, the familiarity trap and also the, maybe a bit of the social trap. Both times on familiar runs that were higher water. One was a class 2-3 run that's nearby Salem, put on way higher than normal, and it was more class 4-5. So that was pretty scary and had a pretty awful swim. Thought and definitely learned the lesson, and so did the other person I was with. The more recent one is paddling another familiar run up in the gorge area, and the gauge reading something that was a familiar level to me, and then putting on, and then a little over a mile into the run, realizing that it was much higher than I'd ever run it, and happy to say that I ended up taking off the river that time. So for me, that was a really good marker of learning some critical thinking skills, and not just feeling, well, I already put on the river, it's going to be a pain to hike out, like my friends are here, you know, that sort of thing, falling into those traps and doing something that potentially could have ended in an unsafe situation. I felt like I made a little bit of a hard decision to not continue having fun with my friends and to hike out. So I think that's a good example of, like, once you're doing the thing and some variable is off, being able to recognize that variable, reconcile it with yourself, and then kind of start from a blank slate and just make the best decision given all of the information that is right in front of you, versus me convincing myself, like, well, the gauge is reading this, so it must be that, and it must just be in my head. So I think that's something that could be applied to other scenarios.
Sure. Let's see. Last spring, I was helping to lead a river trip for the university on the Klamath River. And the intention was to do, I think, a 2 or 3 night stretch just down the lower section. And, you know, we had gotten some rain and some snow was melting, and the river spiked, I think, to like 20 or 30,000 CFS. And I was looking at the gauge the night before, and I hadn't boated this stretch yet, and was leading a bunch of people, a bunch of students that were unfamiliar with river travel. And, you know, the night before we were scheduled to put on, I had called the instructor and said, hey, like, what's the plan? We're looking at 20 to 30,000 CFS. I'm uncertain if, this is the right, you know, boating this stretch is the right choice for this group. And I think that, you know, like, analyzing these decisions or analyzing the environment and the surroundings doesn't necessarily mean that you have to just like call it quits and go to the bar, but that you can change the situation. And so what we ended up doing was leaving the decision up to the morning of, waiting to see what the flow was doing. Maybe it would come down, and changed our plan. And we ended up boating a different stretch of river that suited the group a little bit better. And so just because we're saying, hey, maybe this isn't right, you still have the opportunity to maybe go boat something different, or go do something different that day. It doesn't have to necessarily ruin your day.
I like that. Just remembering that you can't let momentum just keep you going on the same path. You can always revisit these decision making and change your plan and postpone that decision as long as you need to. I have one from early in my boating. We're getting to a rapid, and we decided to line the boats down the rapid. And I had seen that happen a handful of times, so I was using the methods that I'd seen already and thinking they'd probably work on this particular rapid, but it was different enough that they didn't work. And a boat got loose from us, and we had to manage the situation afterwards. But just the idea that something you've seen work a certain way may not be the same once you get to a different situation. So thinking about how that might work differently, I think that's a good one.
Where was that, Dougie?
Giant Gap.
What rapid?
Cascade, or what's that? Is it locomotive?
Locomotive. The one you swam twice?
Yeah.
So it's a different time. Okay, got it. You've had some problems there.
That's another one, a common one is just more in like backcountry rather than rivers, but thinking an area is familiar enough where you sort of know it, you don't take a map. And just realizing that, oh, it's not all quite as small or simple as you think, and a map is pretty helpful sometimes. So that's just a familiarity one that often people fall into.
Or just, you know, going backcountry skiing and looking at the avalanche forecast. I mean, that's an expert halo trap, right? If they say, you know, well, the expert said on the internet that all the slopes were green and good to go, and maybe they're not. I think it's just a good example of like being able to think for yourself and make decisions based on what you're seeing in real time.
Yeah, when I think about when I apply this to my skiing, I think I might never go skiing again in the backcountry. I think I fall in the traps all the time skiing. I'm like, it looks good. I've skied this much. I fall into that all the time. Where boating, I feel like this is really applicable to me. Like, I really like this for boating.
Well, you're using heuristics to make some of those decisions. We're making all our decisions consistently and heuristically, like how to tie,
right,
which leg you put your pants in on first. Yeah. I've heard that example before, but you're always making all these decisions. So a lot of them are deep inside your head. You don't even think about making them, but you have to recognize that some of them are affecting other things down the road.
Yeah. Do you guys think that we're making mistakes a lot because of this? Like that everybody's making, are there some people that are so good they're immune from it, or is like almost no matter what you're making mistakes?
I think it depends on your background and your psychological makeup has a lot to do with it. Like, how do you process information in general? Are you someone that, you know, tends to shortcut things and want to do things as quickly as possible, which is totally what I fall into a trap of.
Yep, me too.
Or like Jacob, someone who often will critically think through things, even if it's like something he does all the time. So he's much less likely to fall into that trap because that's just, that is how he thinks about things and kind of always has. So I have to work much harder at it than he does at this point in our lives. So I think there's a lot of variables. I think a lot of people are making a lot of mistakes all the time, but I don't think, yeah, that's hard to answer.
And I think what's important, I think what you're talking about here is like your experience, right? Your past mm-hmm. experience allows you to make future judgments. Mm-hmm. You may have made a really bad decision in the past and got lucky and then recognize that and say, you know, wow, I'm never doing that again. And I mean, I've done that a number of times, and that's learning. And that kind of gets into this like stages of competency where you're looking at new boaters or somebody who's, you know, unfamiliar with the sport, and they really don't know what they don't know. And so trying to assess that and constantly be learning from your daily decisions. And that's where debriefing becomes important, right? Like, how do you debrief the day? And this is something that we don't do in the private world as much either. But talking about the day and what were the lessons that we learned throughout the day and how are we going to apply that to the future and to our next trip?
So I'm going to try to, my next trip I go kayaking, get like just like on the hood. Or, I mean, I'm still, my hand's still recovering, so hopefully that's soon. I'm going to try to create a social contract among everybody, and at the end of the day, gather everybody together and debrief just to see how that goes.
Sure.
I'm just kind of curious now. Do you think it'll go well, or do you think that people make fun of me?
I think that hopefully it goes well. I mean, it should be well received. And then, you know, like this making fun of you, Zach, like I really appreciate this about you, that you're willing to go out and do this. So willing to go out and do this in a private world, because we don't see it. And I'm wondering if it's because of this shaming culture of things like this, that, is really prevalent in a private world. And that shaming culture is really, you know, I think it's reducing our ability to learn from our mistakes and learn from our everyday boating activities, even if it's, you know, on a very familiar run.
Would this be an acceptance trap where, like, you want to get to take out and just drink beer and talk about how rad you were?
And it's always worked
in
the past, so it's going to work this time, yeah.
And, you know, like, in this private world, too, like, I don't see it being a problem. Like, hey, let's go out and grab beers and talk about the day. Or go out and grab a bite to eat and, like, let's talk about what we learned today so that we can grow and be safer boaters in the future.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally. Something that I think I was, in preparing for this podcast, I was reading about whitewater examples, if anybody had written any blogs about it in terms of heuristic traps. And one of the things that popped up was about how paddlers don't really like to talk about rescues after the fact, or especially when it comes to fatalities, they don't really want to dissect why it happened, what could have been done better. It's kind of a taboo in this sport, where in other sports, they tend, you know, like snow sports, alpine sports, they tend to over dissect things and really dive into what went wrong, what could have been done better. So I think that's something that we could start bringing into the sport a bit more, like especially if it's something like, you know, just someone swims out of their boat, not very scary, but, you know, say someone's throw bag was in a hard to reach spot and it took a really long time to get the person out of the water. That's certainly something that's worth discussing so that that person can improve. And like you were saying, it's important that that person doesn't feel ashamed of their mistake and feels like you're there to help them grow and be better in the future.
And by you reading that, you're gaining judgment too. So I think that's just gaining judgment, like Dustin said, experiencing things yourself and then reading other examples, those are all great tools for getting some of this experience so that when you see these traps, I think we do all fall into them at various times, and it's just how to prevent the big ones from affecting our decision too much. Like, we all are looking at other people run rapids and seeing how they make it and then running it ourselves, but just realizing when that's really impacting whether you run it or not type of thing.
Yeah. You know, as we're talking about this, I'm thinking of examples where fatalities were involved, and I kind of want to bring them up, of examples of how heuristic traps led to it, but I publicly don't want to talk about it. I don't want to maybe shame anybody, and I might have the wrong information about what actually happened. And so I don't want to also spread misinformation, because I don't think the information about those accidents fully gets out. There's just a lot of rumor and conjecture. So I'm a little hesitant right now to bring it up where maybe we should. It was really good. We had Daniel Stillman, who Destinino Daniel was our last guest. And he, at the end of the episode, talked about a fatality, a rescue he was involved in being a part of, and the person passing away. And that was cool to talk to the firsthand person. But I know a bunch of things I've heard secondhand that I'm just so afraid to talk about, because I don't want to, again, shame somebody or make a mistake in the explanation.
Sure.
But I know there's Charlie Walbridge with American Whitewater. He's doing a good job of publishing a lot of the accounts, but I don't think that they're also analyzing them, how it could be solved in the future. I don't know if we should change that or how we would change that, but I've noticed I'm hesitant to say anything.
I think that it's good to, like, it's great that they're being published and that these accounts are accessible. And then it's good to maybe just take the time on your own to read through them and kind of dissect the decision-making process of them. And it could be like the decision-making process behind the rescue itself. Did that person get evac'd? How did they get evac'd? What kind of communication was involved? I think that there's a lot of analysis that could go into rescue reports.
Go ahead, Destin.
Well, I was going to say the other bit of that is that people are afraid to be receiving that feedback.
Yeah, I would. If I made a mistake and almost killed somebody or killed somebody, I don't really need it to be evaluated publicly.
Right.
You know, and like, I think that's really hard for that person to be publicly said, hey, they just, like, their boat spacing was way off. That's why the person, like, got trapped and they couldn't get to him in time. Like, I wouldn't want that on me. Maybe it's a tough one for me.
Sure.
There's lots of learning from that, though.
Yeah.
That is hard.
The shaming part, like, it's not, you're not shaming them. You're not going out of your way to shame them, but, like, bringing up an honest point is, it's a hard thing to for that person and their immediate community to hear.
It's very valuable, though, if it can get out there.
Yeah.
Well, and I think it needs to be brought to their attention in a manner that isn't shaming, that isn't attacking, that, you know, like, what I'm trying to express to you is, like, something for you to reflect on and grow from. This is a gift from me to you in how you can be a better, safer boater in the future. And so having that understanding that, like, I'm not trying to attack you, I'm trying to provide you with thoughtful feedback so that you can be a better, safer boater.
If phrasing it that way, this is a gift for me to you, is an interesting phrasing. I'm trying to think about how I would take that. If you came to me and said, hey, Zach, I'm giving you a gift. FYI, you messed up last week and here's how you should fix it. Yeah, that's interesting.
Well, you can. I mean, there's tons of feedback tools, like asking questions about it, seeing where their what their level of openness is, or if they have. You could say, ask them if they have any questions for you about how things went. I mean, there's lots of ways to approach that.
Sure.
Yeah, and in my experience, Zach, as you know, Jacob gives me lots of feedback on lots of things. And one thing I've learned, and am still learning, is often if you're unable to just receive feedback when it does come from the best of intentions and, you know, is intended to be like a gift from someone to help another person grow, if you can't accept it, I think you have to do some, get the ego off of a pedestal. That's what I've learned, because that's most often the thing blocking me the most from receiving constructive feedback, is feeling defensive or feeling some sort of influence of ego in trying to avoid acknowledging that I could have done something better or did something wrong.
I'm 100% with you on that. And my goal has been to receive feedback with no buts explanation back.
It's really hard. Really hard.
And then my goal has been to respond to that person a day later with a thank you. Like, that's something I've been doing for a while now. And no explanation, no like, you know, like, but well, I did it because of this. Just like, listen to it, take it in, and then provide a thank you to them later. I think that's easy when the feedback is like, hey, maybe you shouldn't have backed the trailer down this place because it, you know, whatever. But when it's the feedback is like, hey, if you hadn't messed up, somebody wouldn't have died. That one's tough.
Yeah.
It's tough to say, hey, I have a gift for you. Here's how you don't kill your friend next time.
That's a different category for sure.
Yeah, I don't know how to provide that feedback.
I mean, they've done studies of like the space shuttle when it blew up back in the 80s, and they know exactly what happened there.
Yeah.
And so some people are to blame, and that's where we learn though. That's how, and it's very hard for those people, but identifying that is going to save countless lives in the future if people learn from those mistakes. Including the people who were involved. So it is hard, but there's so much learning available.
Right. I think like the way you put that, Zach, is a little harsh. Like, here's how to not kill your friends in the future. And I don't know if I'd exactly approach it that way.
Well, I would say it like that, but that's basically what you're telling them. I wouldn't say, hey, so-and-so, I have a gift for you. Here's how you not kill your friends. I get that's harsh. I think you're right. There's a better way to put it, but that's basically what you're telling them.
Right. And so, like, I really like this thing that you said, you know, like, I wait a day and then I say thank you. And so, like, when I'm trying to teach this concept in the field, I like to refer to this analogy. If you do consider it a gift, like, think of it like receiving a Christmas gift from your grandmother.
I don't think anybody thinks of it as a gift. Nobody.
But it's just an analogy, right? Okay. So if you think about it as like receiving a Christmas gift from your grandmother and she gives you an ugly sweater that you just despise, what's the first thing you do? You say thank you.
Yeah.
Right? And then what do? Maybe you try on the sweater, right? And so like that's feedback,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
you just say thank you for the feedback. If you like it, you can keep it and use it in the future. If you don't like it, maybe it just lives in a drawer in your closet for a few years.
Yeah, and the reason that I have done this so much is because I've realized how hard it is to give other people feedback. So if somebody took the time to do something hard, it isn't a casual thing. And so that's why I'm so appreciative, and I take it pretty seriously. And I try hard to, like you say, try it on, because I have so much respect for the fact that somebody – instead of just like making it easy on their life and just letting it go, they've taken time to do something difficult. And if you want to keep receiving feedback, you have to appreciate it, not just be like, say and but make excuses.
That's good. I like that, Zach.
Thanks.
Recognizing that it is hard to do. It's challenging to come up with constructive, like, good feedback, you know. It's really easy to tell somebody they're awesome, but it's really difficult to tell somebody where they can improve.
Yeah, it's not fun. It's not a fun thing to sit down with somebody. You don't want to do it. You're not like, oh, good, I get to go tell somebody that they need to improve something. Nobody wants to do that. They'd rather just like smooth it over, make it easy, and move on.
Yeah.
And so how do you create that culture, especially in this, you know, private world where it's real easy to, you know, hit the takeout, you know, and then go home or go hang out with your buddies afterwards.
Yeah, I think in private boating it's harder. I think it's harder. I mean, when we're commercial guiding, it's kind of our job, so it's still hard. But I think in the private boating world, you know, here's a mistake I made last year. I led that Oregon Whitewater Association trip, and there was a boater on the trip that I like and respect. And he had done something safety-wise that I wasn't excited about. I didn't tell him, but I did post a photo of it on social media, kind of like being like, hey, here's a safety mistake. They didn't have a picture of him. It was just a thing, just a small thing. and he saw it and was mad at me. And so, which for a good reason, like I should have just told him, be like, hey dude, like here's a safety thing. I just, when I'm private boarding, I don't want to go around. I see a lot of safety issues when I go private boarding.
Yeah.
I don't want to go around being the one that's like, hey, by the way, this needs to be this, this needs to be that. Like, it just isn't fun. But what I'm maybe hearing from you guys is maybe there's a sense of responsibility. I don't know. You know, when I'm at work, I'm cool. Like, well, hey, I'm okay, like, pointing out safety issues. But when I'm going for fun, I guess I'm not dying to do that.
We can't take it upon ourselves to save everybody, right? Like, you can do what you can with the team that you're working with, and maybe assist in, you know, the rescue of a swimmer or something down the river, but we can't sit around and lecture everybody at put-in.
That's my thing, is like, how much do we want to make social, like when we're just going kayaking with our buddies, how much energy are we putting into social contracts and debriefs and like pulling people aside and being like, hey dude, like make sure your rope is tied around your boat. That's like kind of like, that's way too loose. Like when you're outgoing for fun with people you kind of know, do you have a responsibility as a leader? Is it up to you? Like, where is that line? Like, what should we be doing? Priscilla, I'm dying to know what you think about this.
I don't know. I feel like for me, it varies so much depending on the makeup of the group and where we are and the purpose of what we're doing. Like if it's an exploratory trip, I'm going to be way more open with setting expectations and like just communicating with people in general, whether positive or negative. Where if it's just like a fun lap with friends on the truss or something, I'm probably not gonna, you know, have a set expectations talk or something like that, because I feel like those kind of runs are like, you know, gym runs or workout runs. It's like we're there to either have fun or to train for other things, so it's kind of, you know, unsaid. But if
let me
I'm taking
an example,
new
like,
people,
sorry, I'm interrupting you, Priscilla. Let me give you an example. Sorry to interrupt. Because okay. I'll forget this. Let's say you're doing the trust with your friends and some other person that you don't know that got invited, and that person doesn't have a throw bag. You notice it. Mm-hmm. Would you, at the end of that day, give them that feedback?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I've done that before. I would feel more frustrated with an experienced boater showing up without a throw bag because they're someone that could help. But if it's someone that's like, you know, new or trying out the run for the first time, or we're taking them down and they, in their nervousness, forgot a throw bag, I feel like I'm totally okay with that because they're the person we're most looking after on the run anyway. And then if that was the case and they were nervous, I wouldn't bring it up at the beginning of the run because they're already dealing with a lot of other things. But you know, at the end of the run or the paddle out, that's not difficult whitewater, I'd be like, hey, you did really great today. Do you mind if I give you a little bit of feedback? I've never had anyone say no to that. And I'll be like, you know, having a throw bag is super important just because you never know what's going to happen. And I'd be like, this is where I like to keep my throw bag, and this is how I make sure that I don't forget it, or, you know, do my best not to forget it, that sort of thing.
And you started by saying, do you mind if I give you a little bit of feedback?
Yeah. I almost always do that unless it's like a rescue scenario and there's not time for niceties or politeness. Like, I'll just yell at someone, you know. But that's a totally different scenario if someone's just on the shore not doing anything and someone's life is in danger. I will yell at them, like, you know, grab a throw bag and help or something like that. But, you know,
but it
most
takes
often the scenario is like after the trip or during the trip, giving feedback and asking, is it okay if I give you a little bit of feedback? And I've never had anyone say no to that.
But I guess the question I'm asking, and I get that, nobody's going to say no. I mean, nobody's ever going to say no, I don't want feedback. Do you mind if I give you feedback as a nicety? I think nobody's like, no, I'm good. I don't need feedback. But the question is, like, when you're a takeout and you give them the feedback about the throwback, for example, mm-hmm. it would be easier just not to do it. It'd be easier just to, like, celebrate your day, sure. talk to your friends. Do you do that because you're just a stand-up person? Do you do it because you feel like you're a leader in the industry? Do you do it because you think it's the right thing to do? Like when I didn't give the guy feedback about his rope, I feel like, I probably should have done that. But I'm like, God, do I want to walk around constantly giving people feedback?
I feel like I don't want to walk around giving people feedback all the time. It's taxing, and of course it's easier just like stoked and go get beers afterwards. But there's been enough scenarios where I've seen that sort of thing end up being really bad, or I've been the person that forgot the throw rope and was like, oh my God, this person's swimming and I'm in the perfect position if I had my throw bag in my hands. Like, I don't want other people to have to experience that. And I'd rather just have the, you know, whatever, feeling of annoyance or like the fear of someone saying, no, I don't want feedback. I'd rather take that than them go on the river the next time and it be with a group of people that aren't as prepared and something terrible happens. I think as any boater that's willing to take other boaters down or finds themselves in any position of influence, whether it be, you know, influencing the one person you're taking down the river, or if you have some sort of known name because you're famous on social media or whatever, it doesn't matter. I think you should feel a little bit of a responsibility to the people that you are influencing. And so giving a little bit of feedback, like having a throw bag is pretty important on a river, even if you know it really well, or even if you're, you know, the person who's just following everyone down the run. I think it's worth giving that feedback.
I really like that.
In the right tone.
and I really like that, Priscilla, too, you know, asking if they're willing to receive the feedback. And I'm sure that that's just like one thing of a myriad of pieces of feedback that you could be giving them. But I think it's important to be really picky and choosy about who you're giving feedback to and what the feedback is. It'd be really easy to unload on somebody and be like, you need to change this, 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 and this. And that might be really hard. But if it was just like, if you were just picking, all right, if out of all these five, like out of these five things, I'm going to talk to this person about the throw bag that they forgot to bring or that they don't have. Right. So it's just, it's really just picking that one piece that is going to be influential or that's important to you in the moment.
Exactly. And the last part is just the timing of the feedback. You know, another example, if someone has a bad swim and it's because they missed a bunch of rolls and they're really scared when you get them to shore, the time to give them the feedback that maybe they should practice rolling is not when they're scared on the river. It's maybe after the run. So I think that's another important part of it as
you're
well.
Not, as soon as they miss swim to shore, you're not going to say, do you mind if I give you some feedback?
Yeah, maybe ask if they're okay and make sure that they can keep going downstream first.
I think also the way that Zach said he receives feedback of, you know, waiting a day, not being defensive and saying thank you. If we all start practicing that, it could shift the culture a little bit and just keep that culture of everybody being a little bit more open to feedback, and then people are more likely to maybe give that feedback. That's a lot to change.
Yeah.
But it, you know, a little, every little bit is just, if you're open to it, maybe that person will give somebody else feedback in the future more likely.
Yeah.
I have to say, just for me, if you come to me and say, do you mind if I give you feedback? I kind of roll my eyes. Honestly, like, I'm like, really? Like, I know it's coming. Like, why are you even asking me? I almost would rather, like, it be approached a different way for me personally, because I'm already like, all right, here we go. We're going into, like, an official talk.
Do you mean you know what the specific feedback is that's coming, or you know there's going to be something?
I'm like, okay, like, all right, here we go. This is a prepped talk they've thought about, and, like, they're coming to me. It's more fun for me when it's more, like, a little bit of jabbing. I'll take it anyway.
See, for me, that doesn't work as well. If I'm like, hey,
Dougie, dude, you got to work on that role, bro. That's embarrassing. That's how I would give it. I wouldn't be like, hey, Dougie, do you mind if I give you some feedback? And you're like, yeah. Like, hey, so, you know, your role, it's kind of need to work on a little bit. Here's a class you can take.
Well, I think those two aren't that different. But sometimes the jabbing could be less direct even than that. Like, you could make fun to somebody else about my role. That would not get to me very well.
Oh, like, if I was talking to somebody else and said, man, Dougie's role sucks and you overheard it.
Exactly.
That's not a good way to give it.
No.
But if I'm, like, sitting down with you and I'm like, man, like, Dougie, your role is a little sketch, dude. We got to work on that.
I'd be fine with that, actually.
Yeah. I'd rather receive it that way, too, personally. Like, if you're like, hey, Zach, man, that didn't go well today. You got to work on that.
Well.
Versus you come to me and saying, all right, can I give you feedback? You know, like, people might receive it differently. I know I don't receive that one well. Hey, we're approaching our time limit, and we probably need to go into gear of the week here for a second. But any last minute thoughts? Dustin, do you want to wrap us up maybe with a conclusion if anybody doesn't have last minute thoughts?
Well, I kind of bringing it back to this idea of heuristics. And with just the understanding that so often in this like academic outdoor leadership world, that heuristics are perceived as a bad thing. And I just want to emphasize that they're not all bad. That heuristic traps are what we're trying to avoid, but that we use heuristics to shorten our decision-making time all the time. And so just getting away from that perception that heuristics are a bad thing, and that we can use them in the right place, but be aware of these six that we discussed.
Cool. Wait, so you're saying heuristics are good or bad?
I'm saying that heuristic traps are bad, but heuristics provide us the opportunity to shortcut our decision making.
So in that case, they're a good thing because we use them a lot. Okay, cool.
Yeah. I think that what I'd like to share is just avoid being dogmatic in the practices, right? Like there was this mnemonic that was around for a while, this reach, throw, row, go. Mm-hmm. And that was like this order of operations that was taught in Swiftwater Rescue for a long time. And then more experience gave the judgment to say, no, actually, this is just a set of tools that we have. And sometimes you just need to jump in the river and go grab somebody.
What's just interesting you bring that up because I'm working on this guide quiz right now and getting feedback about it. And, you know, in the quiz, there's kind of like right and wrong answers, where in the real world, it's more nuanced than just right or wrong answers. So in terms of trying to judge a guide's knowledge, it's hard to give like this isn't how it's always done. This is just a guideline. Like I'm trying to find the wording, like, to not get stuck in dogma and a certain thing, you know. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
Well, and I mean, you use that word guideline, and I think that that's a great way to phrase it. These aren't standard operating procedures necessarily. These are standard operating guidelines.
Yeah. Like, feel free to go outside the box. I think Priscilla just left, so she's not going to do gear of the week. But one thing that we do to wrap up the episode is just talk about some gear that we like or don't like. And I'm not sure if I told you guys about that before the episode. And so I'll go first. And if you guys have something cool, doesn't mean gear, just something in your mind you can use for this. I'll go first. Dougie brought the Knowles Leadership Education Notebook. So my gear of the week is the Knowles Leadership Education Notebook, which I've actually been kind of thumbing through during this talk.
Sure.
And there's just so much good stuff in there. So that's my gear of the week.
Good question. I don't know if I have one off the top of my head right now, Zach.
Doug, you got anything?
I can't think of anything. Last time I had one, you made fun of me. So that was the skull cap.
I provided you feedback.
Yes.
It looks
actually
nerdy.
It does, but it's an incredible piece of equipment. I don't know. I've some cold water boating has definitely helped keep me warm there, Dougie.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, man. You guys are like two peas in a pod. That's a little bit too much of this right now from you guys. Well, cool. Well, you know, thank you everybody who listened to the show. If you have comments, questions, feedback, you can email us at questions@rivertalkpodcast.com. Also, like, we have a website and each episode has a web page. There's a comment section at the bottom of each page where people can actually leave us some comments there. So feel free to leave comments that are visible to everybody. And yeah, see you next week.